for the first time in my life, as I've been reading through the story of Samson, something just started jumping out at me, and I said, wow, he's a type of Israel. I said, Joanna, start doing some research. Hit the computer, hit the internet, find out who else is teaching this. And she came back the next day and said, no one. And I said, oh, no. Because when you're teaching something that a lot of other people aren't teaching, you know, you should get a little scared. Jonathan was walking through my office, and I said, Jonathan, I'm becoming convinced of something that I don't hear any other commentators or professors saying. And he went, oh, no. We're in trouble, you know. But I am. I'm. The more I read each episode from Samson's life, the more I'm absolutely convinced that Samson is a type of Israel. Samson is called. Samson is chosen. Samson is born of the miraculous. Samson is instructed and commanded. Samson is raised up. And I'm sure the other judges are blessed by God, but Samson is the only one of which Scripture says he was blessed by God. But Samson tolerates and tries to use for his own benefit and indulge his own pleasure and embrace the worldly system around him. The very system that he is supposed to be separated from and consecrated from. Last week we talked about the fact, and I'm going to summarize here just to keep the narrative going, that Samson is attracted to a woman. This is where it always starts with Israel. They're looking at the world system around them. They're looking at the daughters of the people of the land. He's attracted to a woman from the people of the land. And he literally tells his parents, and it's a rough translation, but it's the same word used of the nation of Israel. They did what was right in their own eyes. He tells his parents, I'm going to do what's right in my own eyes. I'm going to do what seems right to me. And then we have this parallel conversation, this celestial conversation, and this earthly conversation. God is enacting his own will, his sovereign will, and Samson is enacting his own will. And they're both going in the same direction. They're both heading the same direction. God is strategizing an opportunity to begin the deliverance of Israel from the Philistines, and Samson is strategizing an opportunity to please himself, satisfy himself, indulge his own heart. After tearing apart a lion at a vineyard, and then sometime later going back and getting honey from a honeycomb in the carcass, Samson goes to the bride's house for a wedding, into her town with her friends, her family, and it becomes very clear that Samson, like Israel, Samson is being drawn into the Philistine culture rather than his bride-to-be drawing out of it to his. His ego causes him to make a wager with 30 of these men that he doesn't know, 30 of her townsmen that are coming to celebrate this, if you will, a bachelor party. And she conspires against him. His bride-to-be conspires against him in favor of her own people. And in anger, he goes out and he kills 30 Philistines in order to spitefully pay his debt for the wager he had made. He's not there the final day of the wedding feast, so her father gives her to one of the other men. She is now his wife. And in revenge, Samson burns down the three main crops of the Philistines at harvest time. He devastates the region. In revenge, they burn her and her father alive. They kill them in a fire, which is Philistine custom. And in revenge, he starts slaughtering Philistines. And there you have it. The two conversations converge. And the seed of enmity, or the seed of strife, has been planted between Samson and the Philistines. Today, we're going to look at several episodes, and we're going to go through them one at a time. Samson retreats to a cave in Jewish-controlled area, and the Philistines come, and they pursue him, and they surround that area. Now, this is in Judah, and the men of Judah come out to the Philistines, and they say, you know, what are you doing here? Why are you set to attack? And they tell, the Philistines tell these Jewish men, we're here for Samson. And the Jewish men don't want to get caught in between. They don't want to get destroyed by the Philistines in their pursuit of Samson. So 3,000, think about this, this is very interesting. 3,000 Jewish men from the tribe of Judah go and capture Samson. And they bind him with two new ropes. They promise, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to give you to them to kill you. We won't do it. They will. And he allows himself to be bound. And as they're about to hand him over to the Philistines, the Spirit of the Lord again rushes upon him with mighty force. And Samson, you know, it doesn't exactly say that he broke the ropes, but the connotation is that the ropes were as burnt candle wicks, charred candle wicks around him, and it's as if they just fell off. It was nothing. And he finds not a dried up donkey jawbone, you know, brittle, like a clay jar. He finds a fresh one. He takes this fresh, dead, unclean, get it? And he goes to battle. What a strange picture that is, by the way, because we know that the Philistines have kept for themselves iron. And they have these iron swords and iron spears and iron weapons. And he has a jawbone of a donkey. And he kills 1,000 Philistines. And he sings what is in Hebrew a very eloquent or poetic song. It doesn't quite translate in English, but it's a very poetic song. Samson has this knack for riddles and poems and rhyme. And he throws the donkey bone down, and he realizes after this battle with 1,000 Philistines that he's tired and thirsty. And he cries out to the Lord, acknowledging, I am the servant of the Lord, and this victory has been yours, O God, but I'm thirsty. Have you brought me here to die of thirst in front of your enemies and mine? And the Lord opens up water out of dryness. He quenches his thirst, and he's revived. There are a few things that I would like you to notice about this episode in Samson's life. The first one is the word bind or bound. Bind or bound. It's used 70 times in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is this big, right? Samson's story is this big. It's used 70 times in the Old Testament. 15 of them, we're talking about more than one-fifth of them, are used in Samson's life. He's constantly being bound, constantly being bound, constantly being bound. And it doesn't just mean, like, to tie his hands. Okay, the word literally means to tie up or wrap up. It means to completely control you, to capture you, to enslave you. So don't think necessarily of Samson being bound like this. Think of Samson as being bound like that, completely controlled. Number two. We have seen other judges in the book of Judges rally armies. We saw Gideon's whittled down from 32,000 to 300. During all of Samson's years, 20 years, the only time we see an army rallied is to capture him, to get the judge, to hand over the judge to the enemy. Number three, again, he grabs this fresh jawbone. What is this guy doing? Constantly looking and touching and grabbing the unclean things of the world. This guy has no regard for the vow he has been given and the vow he has assumed. Number four, most profoundly, if you had done your reading like you were supposed to, you would have noticed what the Jewish men say to Samson. Quote, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What have you done to us?" There's a twisted picture here. Samson has been called to be the judge, but he is either so ineffectual or they are so blinded that they really believe the Philistines are in charge. Don't bother. They're not upset with the Philistines. They are upset that Samson has bothered them and that they're caught in the middle. Does anyone hear Israel's story in Samson's story? The Spirit of God moves. There's a miraculous victory. Feigning, maybe, if you will. "You're great. This victory is yours." And then the complaint. Always the complaint. "Why have you brought us here to die of thirst?" Miraculous provision of water out of nothingness. And then a spring gets named. And this time it's named the one who cried out. How many springs have been named in this process of Israel's life? Israel, or you in this room, believer, do you recognize yourself in Samson's story? Do you see the salvation that has been brought to you? Mighty victories in your life. We've been talking about some of them Wednesday night. Mighty victories in your life. Provision, protection, blessing that the Lord has given you. Yet you assume in all of this darkness as you look out there that the enemy is actually in control. And you complain. And you question and you doubt whether or not God will provide your needs. Do you see yourself in Samson's story? Next episode of Samson's life, for some reason, Samson is strolling around a Philistine town. He's like window shopping in Gaza. And he sees a professional street performer. Wait, a prostitute. That's an inside joke from Wednesday night. If you don't know what it is, you missed. He sees a prostitute. He just sees what, oh, man. I got one person that can't stop. He chooses to spend the night with her. The townspeople have, I saw a lot of smiles. It was kind of like this. Oh. Townspeople have recognized Samson. They've recognized him. They know he's in their town, and they surround and they plot to kill him. Under the cover of darkness, he gets out, and he tears down the city gates. Now, these are the gates from the walls around the city. These walls are huge. These gates are somewhere between 10 and 20 feet tall. They are double-clad wood-planked gates that have iron on them, Philistines, iron. And they are put into the beams with rock or stone hinges. These are huge. There's this miraculous event again. This strength comes upon Samson, and he tears these things out of the city wall of Gaza and carries them a great distance away. And he plants them on top of a hill to be seen in Jewish-controlled territory, putting your enemy's city gates on display in your territory is a sign of victory over your enemy. We've left you vulnerable. You can do nothing to stop us. There are a few things that I want you to see in this episode of Samson's life. Number one, why is this separated, consecrated, blessed man strolling through the enemy's territory? Why? Why is this consecrated, set-apart man indulging his own lusts, his own passions, his own will, his own heart with a woman from the people of the land, let alone a prostitute? Why does this man, who is supposed to be a light in the darkness, allow himself to be hemmed in by the darkness? Does anyone hear Israel's story in Samson's life? He's not driving out the Philistines from the land. He's strolling through and admiring the enticements of the enemy. He's attracted to a woman from the land, a prostitute no less. He embraces her, and he's caught. He's ensnared. And again, this miraculous strength comes upon Samson, and the Lord causes him, in a moment of peril, to have and demonstrate victory over the enemy. Israel, believer, do you see any reflection of yourself in Samson's life? How often and how long are you willing to stroll through the enemy's territory? How long are you willing to toy with the idea of all the indulgences and all the enticements of the enemy? How long are you willing to allow this darkness to encroach upon you? What's it going to take to break? Next, we're told that Samson actually falls in love. He falls in love with a valley girl. Like, yeah, for real. That's all it says about her. She's from the valley. Got you with that one, too. He shakes his head a lot, you know. The Bible doesn't explicitly tell us who Delilah is. There is nothing that directly points to her as being a Jewish girl, nothing. But while there is some debate, most scholars think that she is a Philistine prostitute. Number one, that's sort of a pattern in his life. But the Philistine rulers and the Philistine men seem to be very familiar with Delilah. And they don't threaten her life the way they threatened the life of his bride-to-be earlier. They entice her with money. They know her weakness. And it doesn't appear that Samson marries her, because she doesn't come to live in his house. He continually goes to visit hers. So I'm going to go with the assumption that she is a Philistine prostitute. It appears that the five rulers of the five Philistine cities offered Delilah what would be in our modern-day equivalent, $35,000 for one act. Help us capture Samson. And she tries to find the secret of his strength three times without success. She quite literally asks him again with this word bound, tell me how we can capture you. Tell me how we can enslave you. Tell me how we can completely have control over you. I'm gone if that's me. I'm like, oh, never mind. I'm not even going to, if I'm sipping coffee, oh, I'm going to put the coffee down and back out of the house. I don't get it. I don't understand why he plays this game. The first time he tells her, with 7 straps of fresh cut leather or animal sinew, undried. Again, you know, a dead, unclean thing. Go ahead, wrap that around me. Second time he tells her, with new ropes, ropes that have never been used before. The third time he tells her, take my hair, my 7 locks of hair, and weave them into the fabric on the loom. All of this to no avail. You think the first time she shouted, Samson, Samson, the Philistines are upon you, he would have caught on. Yes. Amen, sister. Then we're told that she approached him with such pressed him so much. So much that he couldn't take it anymore. He tells her, I'm a Nazarite. It's my hair, lady. It's my hair. That night, she has his head shaved. And this time, he is bound. He is captured. He is enslaved. They have control. And what do? They pluck out his eyes. And they put him to work for them. They literally make him their slave. There are a few things that I would want you to observe from this episode in Samson's life. Number one, notice that Samson is fully aware, completely recognizes that he is a Nazarite. And notice that he understands the consequences of breaking his vow. My strength will leave me. He's not unaware. He's not caught off guard. He is not oblivious of his own condition. Sin never catches us off guard. Ever. Number two, regarding a Nazarite vow, there are instructions of things to abstain from. There are instructions of sacrifices to make, things to participate in. But the sign of a Nazarite is the hair, the uncut hair. Numbers 6:7 literally says the Nazir, the separation of God, is upon their head. It is their crown. It is not an uncommon thing to see a Jewish man who is sober. That's not uncommon. Abstain from alcohol or anything that comes from the grape. It is not uncommon to stroll through Israel and see a sober Jewish man. It is not uncommon to see a Jewish man abstain from touching unclean things or dead things. It's not uncommon. But what was uncommon? The thing that is to be the sign of this vow, this absolute commitment, is the unshaven nature of their appearance. He's been breaking his vows. He has been breaking his vows like crazy. Vineyards, carcasses, prostitutes. But cutting his hair, removing the sign, was breaking the relationship. This is some big deal. Number three, notice that when he awoke, he said, I will go out as at other times and shake myself free, but, it's my best Samson, but he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. He didn't know. Although she had proven herself faithful in treachery, She had proven herself time and time and time again faithful in her betrayal. He was lulled to sleep, Christian. He was lulled to sleep, caught off guard regarding his own spiritual condition. Number four, notice again and again and again. He strolls around, he's walking around, he's looking at, and it says, he saw a Philistine from Timnah. He saw a prostitute from Gaza. And here he sees Delilah and falls in love with her. As I've taught you so many times, there comes a point in our time where the Lord says, okay, have it your way. I have tried to stop you, I've tried to stop you, I've tried to teach you, I've tried to discipline you, I've tried to punish you, I've tried to instruct you, have it your way. Go ahead. And what do they do to him? They pluck out his eyes. After seeing and saw and seeing, they pluck out his eyes. And he's bound and he's enslaved and he's serving the enemy. He's become their slave. Does anyone hear Israel's story in Samson's story? He knows his calling and he knows the consequences, but this time he's all in. I mean, he gives away his heart, his will. And he treats this, doggone it, he treats this moment as like some sort of game. Like this is playful. He's not breaking a rule here. He's not breaking a rule there. This time he's breaking the relationship of this covenant. Nothing's left. Nothing is left to do once his head is shaved. The Lord departs. The Spirit of the Lord leaves him. And in effect, says, have it your way. He's bound, he's blinded, he's enslaved. Israel or believer, do you see yourself in this episode of Samson's life? You know your calling. You know the consequences. They're spoken, they're spelled out for you. But you keep behaving as though this is some sort of game. This Christian thing. Game of checkers. Hop a little here, hop a little there, and maybe I'll get across and get crowned someday. Some of us tread really close to that line. Tread close to the cliff, and we back off. And we tread close to the cliff, and we back off. Some of us cross that line. Indulging our will and having the awful, horrific consequences of it. Remember the two conversations, the celestial one and the earthly one? While Samson seemed to be unaware of the celestial one, the Philistines weren't. The Philistines understand. They clearly know that this is a battle between their God and Samson's God. They get it. They state it. They believe they've won. And to some degree in Samson's life, they have won. He's their slave. He is embracing the consequences of doing what is right in his own eyes, and he's their slave. However, the sign of Samson's consecration is being restored. The Philistines want to celebrate. They want to celebrate the victory that their God has given them over Samson and his God. So they bring Samson to their God's temple. The rulers of the five cities are there. The temple, and these are big, huge places, by the way. I want you to think about this for a second. We could probably stand, 150 people in this room comfortably. On the terrace roof of this temple, they have 3,000. These are huge temples. If you've ever been in any of these ancient places, you realize how big these things are. The temple is filled, and on the terrace roof, there's 3,000. They're watching the spectacle of Samson. I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us what it means that Samson performed for them. I don't know what that means. But at some point in time, he's exhausted. Obviously, humiliated. And he secures for himself a position between two of the support pillars for this temple. And he prays to the Lord for just one more moment of strength. Just one. Why? Did you read it? To avenge my eyes. Not to avenge your name, O God. Not to avenge Israel. But to avenge my eyes. God imparts the strength. And you know the story. He breaks the pillar and the temple collapses. All the leaders and all the people that were inside the temple, they're dead. His family retrieves the body and they bury him in his family's tomb. And he's known for killing more Philistines in one moment of his humiliation than in his life as a judge. There are a few things that I would like you to notice about this episode in Samson's life. Number one, as we've looked at the circumstances in which the Israelites keep finding themselves in this book of Judges, of the 10 or 11 times that we have seen the Lord deliver them from their enemies, only one of them has any faint acknowledgement of we've sinned and we're so sorry. All the other times, they are not in sorrow for their sin. They are in sorrow for their consequences. And in my life, and in 20 years of ministry, and in 10 years of being the pastor of this church, I have yet to have someone come to me and say, I am in so much sorrow and distress over my sin. We all say we are in so much sorrow and distress for the consequences of our own actions. Oh, please, how do I get out? Oh, God, how can I be relieved of this? Crying out for deliverance. Sometimes, even crying out for revenge on those we believe have caused us the problem. And here you see Samson. He's not confessing his sin, which is great. Obvious. I've broken vow after vow after vow. I've broken the sign. He's not confessing. He's not saying, I repent. He's saying, give me revenge. Maybe in a twisted way, this one last time, he's, you know, a sense of deliverance or a sense of relief from his life, but certainly above all, revenge. And the Lord delivers him and strikes the enemy. Number two, we've looked at 11 judges so far prior to Samson. With other judges, there is some verbiage, there is some language, sometimes direct quotes that say, you know, so-and-so judged Israel for so many years and the land was at rest, or the land was at peace, or it was undisturbed for so many years. But with Samson, it says, he judged Israel for 20 years in the time of the Philistines. Think about that. This is not the time of Othniel. This is not the time of Deborah. This is not Samson's time. This was the Philistines' time. This was the Philistines' time. There's no mention of rest. There's no mention of calm. And there's no mention of peace. What do you want more than anything in life? What do you want? Peace. Number three, I want to draw your attention to something sort of obscure. When God the Father took Israel, the nation, the people, as his beloved, as his spouse, he gave them do's and don'ts, a whole long list, a summary of 10 categories of do's and don'ts. And he told them that there was a sign of this covenant, a sign of this espousal, a sign of this relationship. What was it? Huh? No, that was Abraham. Sabbath. And this shall be a sign between you and I. Sabbath rest. Sabbath, a day of rest for the individual, the family, and as the nation gathers as a whole, as a unit, a time of rest for the nation, for the land. And there's instructions about the Sabbath sign. Israel breaks this do, breaks that don't, back and forth and back and forth, constantly adulterates themselves with other gods. God calls them adulterous. But she is ultimately condemned. It's like Capone getting pinched for tax evasion, right? She is ultimately condemned for the Sabbath, for breaking the rest. And she is sentenced to serve the same exact time in captivity as she did not allow the Sabbath rest to take place for the nation. And Ezekiel gives us this, I don't know, dramatic or maybe even heart-touching look into what happens as God leaves the temple and looks, leaves the city gate and looks, is on a hill and looks. Spirit of the Lord has left. And the people went about their day, went about their business, went about their lives, completely unaware until they were taken into captivity. Samson breaks the do's and don'ts time and time and time again. Samson is continually with these women, these prostitutes. He's ultimately condemned for breaking the sign. And he is completely unaware that the Spirit of the Lord has left him. Until the enemy rushes in. And now he is bound and captive, and they're in control. In time, as Israel's sign is restored and the land has its rest, she is released from captivity. And in time, as Samson's sign is restored, he is released from his captivity. This nation of Israel needs to see the believer. Needs to see yourself in Samson's story. Have you in the past, or are you right now, are you about to experience God say, okay, my dear child, my beloved, have it your way. Do what's right in your own eyes. Do what makes sense to you. Even though I've spelled it out, do it. Indulge your will, not mine. Indulge your heart, pursue your heart, not mine. It's not always in the debaucherous either. Christian, sometimes we're so busy, so active, doing what we think is right. We don't even realize he's not in the room and he's knocking outside the door. Let me in. Are you just crying for relief? Are you just crying out to God for relief? Dare you cry out for vengeance? Oh, dare you? Are you crying out for relief while he is seeking remorse? Are you seeking revenge while he is crying out for repentance? As we conclude our study of Samson, this judge, this man of no character, I want you to have three profound truths. I ask you to mull these things over. I ask you to think about them through the week. I actually ask you to write them down or tap them out or whatever you do, swipe them away, you know. But think about them. Run them over in your head and your head and your head and your head. In every episode of Samson's life, I can, and I hope you can, see a synopsis of Israel's life. There seem to be five episodes, five distinct stories that we are told about in Samson's life, and each one of them shows us Israel. Samson is a living, breathing illustration of Israel to Israel. Therefore, because their story is, he is a living, breathing illustration for us. To observe, to understand, to see ourselves in. If I have preached on Samson for 3 weeks and you have not been convicted at some point in time over this process of sin, you haven't been listening because I have. Do you see yourself? Number two, please, please understand, please know that the enemy always, say that word with me, always. Now let's try that again before I come down and slap somebody. One, two, three, always. The enemy always knows that the battle is between the God of this world and your God. The one true God. The enemy always knows that. The enemy always knows that it is the indulgence of the will, capitulation to the heart, that leads to slavery. That is the enemy's strategy. The enemy always, always calls us to tolerate. Dirty word. The enemy always calls us to compromise. Dirty word. And the enemy never does. Never. Not once. Not an inch. Our battle is not against flesh and blood. You need to know and you need to recognize, you need to see that you are surrounded by a world system that hates your God. They're not even making it covert anymore or secret. They're not even feigning respect. It's blatant. It's open. They hate your God. They hate his principles, his precepts, and they hate his people. It's constantly enticing. Enticing you, enticing me, enticing the church to compromise. Number three, finally, last thing. What I found most disturbing is that Samson never came to terms with his set apart, consecrated calling. He never came to terms with it. He could speak it. He could relay it. He could give the image of it. But he never embraced it. He never embraced his consecrated, set apart calling. Israel never embraced her consecrated, set apart calling. The church has not come to terms with its consecrated, set apart calling. Have you? Have you come to terms with your consecrated, set apart calling? Challenge number three. The sin you allow is the sin that will enslave. Challenge number two. Brothers and sisters that need a function, a family. Brothers and sisters that need teaching of purity and peace. Challenge number one. Consecrated light in a dark, dark world.